Well, welcome, good people. Welcome back to Trespassing Allowed, where boundaries are meant to be crossed, stories are meant to be shared, and yes, laughter is still the best way to navigate life's unexpected detours. So here we are. I mentioned last time that I am now at the end of my sabbatical. What is a sabbatical? You hear it a lot. College professors, they take a sabbatical. People who may go from one business to the next, they take a sabbatical. To me, a sabbatical is kind of like recess. It's a time where you get to leave what you have been doing for a long time. You go and you relax, you reflect, you kind of look at your past and you decide, okay, what is my next chapter? So yeah, as of Thursday, yesterday, 4:01 p.m., I left Deaconess in my semi-retirement mode, a hospital that I've been at. Some will say 5 years, some will say 6.5. We'll talk about that later. But it was a nice opportunity for me to create a time in my life where once I sold my business, which we'll discuss landscaping later, I was retired for about 2 days. And I knew I wasn't ready to quit. I knew I wasn't ready to retire. I'm not that kind of person. But sure enough, 2 days after I had sold my business, signed the papers, cashed the check, actually, I think I put most of the check into some kind of a savings account. I was with my very, very good friend and first cousin, Bob Scheller. We were riding our bikes. He said, John, what are you going to do with the rest of your life? I don't know, Bob, you know me, I'll probably do something, but I guess God has a plan. Sure enough, yes, Bob had a plan for me also. Deaconess Hospital became my sabbatical. I was able to go there, work outside 90% of the time, do my very best to keep the place looking good. But it was really coming from a businessman who for 30 years ran a business, owned a business, 10, 20, 30 employees at times. It was a great opportunity for me to breathe again. I went from an 8.5 stress level to about a 1.5. I was able to see a company with 11,000 employees versus running a company with a very, very small amount compared. But a sabbatical, I feel, is very important regardless of where you are in your life, what you're doing. I think it's good to take a break. I think it's good to take some time. Now, some people will say, wait a second, you were working for this hospital. How do you call that a sabbatical? If you've ever owned a business, you've ever got to work 80, 90, 100 hours a week, being able to work for someone in doing something that you've done for 30 years, I can tell you it's not hard. I was amazed at in this hospital, which I actually did get to work inside for a couple years, exchanging filters. It was an opportunity that for the first time, I didn't have to make any decisions. I was lucky enough to be in the maintenance and engineering department, in the grounds department, and it was a wonderful opportunity where I maybe had to talk to a boss or a manager maybe a couple minutes a day. Sometimes I could go a whole week and not have to talk to anyone. They gave me an opportunity where as long as I checked off the list of things to do, it was really a great opportunity for me to exhale. Wonderful benefits. It also gave me a chance to become a coworker again versus being an owner. So take an opportunity if you get a chance. I will admit, I didn't think I'd be there for as long as I was, but there was always some unfinished business. But a sabbatical, look it up, think about it, try to take one at some point in your life where you're really wanting to really decide what will my last chapter be all about. Whether your last chapter is 5 years, 20 years, 40 years, sometimes it's good to take a break, and this sabbatical that I am just coming off of is something you'll hear me talk about a lot because this hospital, Evansville, Indiana, second best hospital in the entire state, a hospital that really truly cares about caring and compassion, a hospital that has been around for a very long time. I felt very fortunate to be able to be a small part of it for a while. But with my sabbatical, I'm also excited for the rest of my life because of the things I've been planning for 30 or 40 years. And hence, a big part of it is this podcast is something that I knew years and years ago, if given the chance, if given the opportunity. Yeah, I'd like to tell you guys a little bit about my life, which is really more reflected in the people that I have met, individuals, great individuals that I'm kind of really living my life through them, or some will say their lives are being now lived through you. However you want to look at it, I'm really happy to be here today. One of the things I'm looking forward to, you hear me talk about having different groups of friends, and I've shared that with you. My 20 good fun friends that we get to do a lot of crazy fun things together. We're going to do a fishing trip. So if you're around Lake Cumberland, somewhere on the last week of June, you're going to see a whole bunch of us out there. We've got three boats. We got four side-by-sides, a four-wheeler. We'll have 47 fishing poles. We'll have at least 1,000 bass lures, including a chartreuse sexy shad, which is a must if you're wanting to catch a big bass. But anyway, I am going to really start enjoying doing some of the fun things that I didn't always have all the freedom to do. But at the same time, because this podcast is very much about wanting the people out there that may want to someday do their own gig, do their own thing, it has been a wonderful life where I've got to do a lot of fun things. Because if you are in charge of your own business, if you are the boss, if you are the person that's responsible for employees, one of the nice things is you do have the opportunity to come and go when you please. So with that being said, I thought today we'd have a little tell us a story, Uncle John moment. Uncle John loves telling lots of stories. Uncle John gets to, at certain times, tell stories that are usually age appropriate, but they're usually stories that, as I look back on my life, they define my life. They tell you about my life. I don't know if I got to mention this last time, but on my last week at Deaconess, I want to throw a shout out to the young children at the Enrichment Center. While I was at Deaconess, I maintained kind of one of the child care areas, and I had an absolute blast every day getting to go by and talk to the kids from the age of 1.5 to, say, 6 years old. And over time, we became good friends with about 50 or 60 of them, and I was absolutely honored that on Tuesday, they had a special farewell to Mr. John. I took Miss Tammy with me. They had no idea I was married. So Tammy came with me, and for about an hour, we got to share some really fun stories. I got some nice cards from them. Anytime I was at Deaconess, and if the day wasn't quite going the way I was hoping or wanting, I could always take a ride over to the daycare center, and I could pull up to the fence and all the kids would come running. And it was just a great way to say, oh, hey, hi, I'm finally talking to some intelligent people. We'll talk about synthetic turf here a little bit later, but I will never forget that they said, Mr. John, this is not synthetic turf. This is pretend grass. See, this grass is called pretend grass. So I'm like, that is brilliant. I need to market my synthetic turf as pretend grass. But today, let's tell a story that occurred in my college years. As a communications major and a psych minor, a lot of communication classes, and the one I remember in particular, one specific day for 1 hour, we talked about something that, quite honestly, I think I will never forget. And quite honestly, I'm not sure how often people think about this. The way it went was we were going in. Creative writing was fun for me. I loved writing stories. I do remember one of the stories I wrote was about a spring break where a bunch of the guys in my fraternity and a bunch of sororities, we all headed down to Fort Lauderdale. This was back in the early 80s. And I remember writing the story that that was that first time I got to go out, be on my own with a bunch of my friends in a different state. I don't know, spring break, there's just something special about it. You can always see that every year the TV channels, the news channels love to pick up on all the antics and fun and excitement of spring break. And I remember coming back and writing a story about my days at Fort Lauderdale, which I'll share another time. But on this particular day, I remember our professor came into the class and I remember him saying to all of us, "All right, guys, everyone, put your books away. Put your pencils away. We're going to talk about a topic today that I think is extremely important." So I was intrigued. This sounded like something he felt very strongly about. And so as we sat there, he began to tell us about something he felt from a communication standpoint that is extremely important, extremely critical. He started off by talking about what is a threat. What are threats in our world that make us nervous, stress us out? He went to one extreme to where some people can be threatened with bodily harm. Sometimes you can be in a place, particularly if you're a female, and you may feel very uncomfortable with what you perceive as a threat. In extreme cases, threats can be physically abusive. You could be at home and my God, you hear a noise upstairs, a window being cracked. You're in a very dark and lonely place and maybe there are people around that you feel very uncomfortable with. So there are extreme cases of something that can be very threat-producing. Gosh, nowadays you hear about people who are building new houses. They have a panic room or they have an area. And he went into fairly explicit detail on just how bad a threat can be, how bad something can occur that really shakes you to your core, and how sometimes these threats produce devastating and terrible things. But then he said there's other types of threats. Sometimes things can be threat-producing where just in our language, how we talk, how we present ourselves, how we carry on a conversation, that the way we talk, the inflection in our voice, the topics we're discussing, there's a whole lot of things out there that makes the difference between what is threat producing and what is threat reducing. And as I listened, I started thinking about the times in my life where in having conversations with people, in having conversations with a boss or a manager, classmates, or maybe in athletics, things that you hear or things that you say, are they threat producing? Or as he was trying to point out, can they be threat reducing? And he spent a whole lot of time talking about when you're talking with people, whether it's one-on-one or a group, you're with a fun group having fun at the end of the day, you're in a classroom, you're in a boardroom. What you say and how you say it can be looked at as either being threat producing or threat reducing. And he said, let's be honest. If you are talking with someone, if you're having a conversation, if it's a deal on a car, if it's a landscape project, if you're talking with employees or employers, are the words you speak Are they going to be threat producing? Are they going to be threat reducing? And the more I thought about it, the more I started taking notes, I started to think, you know, how often have you been in a situation where you've just had a conversation with someone and you walk away from the conversation and you're either one, smiling, happy, excited, relaxed, or two, you're coming away and you're not feeling well. You're not thinking that went well. Was it something that they said or was it something that you said? The difference between threat producing and threat reducing is something that we very seldom really think about. How often do I go into a conversation, whether it's with my wife or my kids, whether it was with my employees or my customers? How often do we go into a conversation and really think about what I'm about to say? Is it going to be perceived as threat producing or is it going to be perceived as threat reducing? Because unless I'm a masochist or a sadist, I really think I'd prefer a conversation to be more threat reducing. But have you noticed, it seems like a lot lately, there's a lot of stress-producing conversations. I'll talk later about the difference between a conversation and a condemnation. But it occurred to me that we do have the ability, each and every one of us, we do have the ability that when we are talking with others, that we can control the stress and the threat level. For years later, every time I saw a threat-producing conversation or was involved with a group of people that were coming away a lot more pissed off than they were when they started, many times it was not a punch that was thrown. It wasn't someone got kicked. It wasn't a tackle. It wasn't a takedown. No, it was how one person communicated with the other person. This professor in a creative writing class gave us some information that to this day was so much more important than any story I wrote or any story I read. His point was this, that before you speak with anyone, if you take a millisecond and you say, what can I say? What pronouns can I use? What words, what verbs, what nouns? My interjection, my tone of voice. How can I have a conversation with someone to where at the end of this conversation, regardless of what we talk about, that this person can go away from me feeling I was threat reducing versus threat producing? I thought that was brilliant because in today's world, and it's been happening for a long time, the conversations that we create, the conversations that we have, at the end of the conversation, have we become closer to creating a friend? Or are we now taking a back step and wondering, gosh, do I really want to have another conversation soon with this person? And the more I thought about it, and the more I started watching other people and how they communicate, the more I realized that this 1 hour, if we could dwell on it more often, maybe we could be a people, maybe we could be a country, maybe we could be a part of mankind that remembers that if we're going to move forward, if we're going to improve where we are today, that threat-reducing conversations will want us, in many cases, to make that leap forward. Here's the sad part for some people. Regardless of how hard they try, I've seen it with managers, I've seen it with bosses, I've seen it with teachers, I've seen it with all walks of life. No matter how hard they try, the inflection in their voice, the way they choose their words, people just perceive them as being threat-producing. People will say, I don't know why they don't want to talk to me. I don't know why they don't text me back. I don't know why they just don't seem to like what I have to say. Unfortunately for those people, and part of this comes from my psychological background, the words you chose, the intent in your voice, the inflection of how your facial expressions were perceived made you more threat-producing than you even realized. Have you ever met some of those people? I know a few women. They can tell you the meanest, baddest, worst things in the world, but just the way they say them to you, you come away laughing. You come away smiling. There's an art to being threat reducing. There is a way and a number of words that can be used that even if I am reprimanding an employee, there is a way that I can go about it, that I can start off with something positive. I can tell them what they need to work on. But in the entire conversation, I can continue to lift them up. In the entire conversation, I can try to dwell on the positive parts versus the negative parts. A lot of this podcast is going to be dealing with what is perceived as accepting and trying to dwell on the positive and staying away from the negative. In your conversations, if most of the conversations is dwelling on the negative, if most of that conversation has a negative influence to it, most likely you're going to feel that the stress has been more produced than reduced. Being threat reducing, I have found time and time and time again, will make a group work harder. It will make a person be more productive. If I come away from a conversation and it's a person who may be above me or a person who may be my manager, a person that may be he's my client. He's the one that's writing the check to me, to my company. If I can come away from the conversation with laughter, with a smile, with a feeling inside that says, you know what, this person, for some reason, I feel better now than I did when I met him or her, versus, wow, that didn't go so well. I did not do this very well. Is John M. Schrader sometimes a threat producer? Yeah, I don't want to be. I didn't plan on it. Something was said, a spark was created where I went from being the happy-go-lucky guy who everybody thinks they want to be around to I suddenly found myself in a debate. I suddenly found myself trying to persuade this person against their will. And man, when I come away from that, I really have to process what that was all about. How often do you think about the words that you're about to choose? How often do you think especially a planned conversation of where you want that conversation to go. Yeah, there's a lot of conversations. I think that's where we came with road rage, where suddenly, instantaneously pisses you off, or instantaneously you've pissed somebody else off. We have the ability, each and every one of us, to carry on a conversation and try to make it a threat-reducing conversation. What are the words that we can use that will make people appreciate having the conversation? Are we smiling when we're talking? Are we laughing? Can we kid? You know, we were having a conversation the other day about one of the problems with social media is that as we're texting each other, one of the things you don't get to do in a text, even with an emoji, is you don't get to see the facial expressions of the person you're talking to. Facial expressions are so important. I've had people say what could be very daunting, very, very mean, but I can see in their facial expression that they are laughing inside and they're laughing outside. They're smiling. You know, a lot of us love to kid each other. A lot of us love to say something that in a text would actually look mean or cruel. But in reality, no, we're having fun with people. And I am one that I love having fun with people. I can have as much fun with a stranger as I can with a person I've known for 40 years. But am I being threat reducing or am I being threat producing? Go to a party sometime and look around, and there will be some groups of people that are having conversations, that are laughing, enjoying the moment. And you go up and you listen to the conversation, and it's a conversation that the exact same group on the other side of the room may be having, but you can see in the facial expressions, you can see in the lack of laughter, you can see that it's being said in a different way. It's being said by people who do not understand the difference of threat reducing and threat producing. I have had amazing managers. In fact, even with my gig at Deaconess, managers that can tell me something or tell others something, but they tell it in a way that, hey, I still have great respect for you. I still think the world of you. I still see great value in you, even though they're maybe telling you something that you don't want to hear. Where unfortunately, I have also seen the manager who, after he has that two-minute conversation, no matter what company he works for, the person walks away with their head down. The person walks away where they feel they have not been respected at all. They feel like they have been put in their place. They are walking away not feeling like I want to be productive for that person now. In fact, I think I may not want to be productive for that person at all. If you are in a management position, and I don't care if it's lower management, middle management, or you're the CEO of a company, there are great CEOs out there. There are great places to work because the person in charge of the company makes sure that everyone in management makes sure that when you talk to your employee, your coworker, your co-producer, you talk to them in a way with great respect. You talk to them and you make them feel like they want to go out and they want to do the world for you. A good friend of mine, I'll just say his name, Ira Boots. Ira is a local gentleman here that he ran one of the most successful businesses, Berry Plastics. And Ira, yep, he was a wrestler. He was a darn good wrestler. And he was a gentleman that, as Berry Plastics grew both locally and then nationally and then internationally, I would talk to people that worked for Berry. And I said, why do you think Berry Plastics has done so well? Why are they growing and growing and growing? And they always brought up this one guy. He was the CEO. He was a guy that they said that, you know what, he would come into the plant and he had a way of making you feel amazing. Didn't matter what part of the plant, you know, Berry did a lot of plastics and enclosures and a lot of different things. But he said, Ira Boots was just a guy that, it was a handshake, a pat on the back. It was a few words or it was a 10-minute conversation. Ira Boots is one of those guys that you would do anything for. He could ask you to work ungodly hours. He could ask you for anything. Ira Boots was a threat-reducing CEO. He was the kind of guy that was kind of like, for many people, they said he was like a father figure. He's a gentleman I get to see on occasion. We see a lot of wrestling during wrestling season, and I get to see him on occasion. And I always love to go up and shake his hand and ask how he's doing, and he's always got that smile on his face. And, you know, gosh, is Ira perfect? I'm pretty sure he's not perfect, because I'm pretty sure that we all are not perfect. But I will tell you this. And I never got to work for him, but he is the epitome in my thought that he is the perfect example of a threat-reducing person. He could be in a position of being threat-producing, but no, he's that kind of guy. He knows the words. He knows how to make you feel good. But if you are that individual out there who you find yourself constantly feeling, why are people not wanting to spend time with me? And they're always with these other guys and what's going on? Look at yourself in the mirror sometime. Record yourself sometime. I know that sounds crazy, but record yourself. Is what I'm saying a threat? Reducing conversation? Am I looking at the positive and dwelling on the positive? Or am I not? It's not an easy thing to change. But here's what I can tell you. You can change. There are ways around changing yourself and the way you have the conversation. We'll talk about it later in more detail. I hope I'm not boring you with this. Why is this so important? Podcast 4, you're talking about threat reducing versus threat producing. Why is it so important to you, John? I'll be honest, I'm pretty happy with my life. I look back over 64 years and I am seeing a lot of my life as being a hell of a lot of fun. I could work the 80 or 90 hour week, but I still enjoyed the fun. When I talk about loving people, it's because many of my conversations with people were threat reducing conversations. Whether it was at a bar, having a couple beers, on a camping site, on a nice rafting trip, or canoeing in the Missouri River. And I ask myself, why do I think my life has been this happy? Why do I think this life has been successful in my terms of success? And it's because, honestly, if I talk to 90 people, I honestly feel like about 88 of them, we had that threat-reducing conversation that made us want to get together again. We had that conversation that we ended in a hug, or we ended in a high five or a handshake. How often in your conversations, when you're talking to strangers or people you've known every day, how often at the end of that conversation do you want to give them a hug? You want to give them a kiss? You want to pat them on the back. If you're doing that a lot, something tells me you know the definition of being threat reducing. If that's not happening very often and you're walking away with a bit of a scroll, you're walking away kind of wondering, man, where did that conversation go to? If that's happening too often to you, I'm here today to tell you that maybe the new term threat reducing versus threat producing may have something to do with where you are in your life. I don't know where you are in your life. That's between you and your God, you and your family, you and your employer, you and your employees. It's between you and your dog, you and your cat. I don't know where you are in your life. But I will tell you this, if you would like your life to be happier, if you would like to see more content in your life, if you would like your time with people to be one that you can come home at the end of the day and tell your wife or your husband, hey, I had a great conversation today, and go to bed at night with that smile on your face, thinking about the conversations that you had, think about what you said. Think about how you said it. Were you laughing when you were doing it? Were you smiling? Were they smiling? Because I tell you this, in all my years, in the tens or hundreds of thousands of conversations, if I could catch myself before I said something wrong, and I could catch myself and say, John, try to be threat reducing. 9 times out of 10, yeah, it was a conversation that I couldn't wait to have with that person again. All right, so threat producing, threat reducing, you'll hear me talk about it. You'll hear me talk about, is that person cocky or is he just confident? And I'm going to jump back to this moment. So real quick, a little bit more. John is a landscaper, a landscaper, a landscaper. What makes him so happy to be a landscaper? 2 things I want to talk about real quick. First of all, did I mention that my mother was 92 this week? 92 years old, wonderful lady, wonderful disposition, still has a great feeling about people. No question, my mother really and truly is a big reason on why I think I am who I am today. Remember, she's that lady, could see the positive in anything and everything. But I got to read you a poem, and I'm not going to say exactly which sister it was, but it was a moment that we had at her birthday party that at the age of 92, she still loves to smile. She still loves to laugh. Unfortunately, because of dementia, she doesn't remember things that she talked about 5 seconds ago or 10 seconds ago. Dementia, which I think all of us, it's touched our lives in one way or the other. It's a very tough, tough thing. But you know me, I love to laugh, and there was a laughing moment where my mother at 92, we were able to have a nice big pizza party with her at West River, which I'm going to say, hey, you know, if you're in the Evansville area, check out West River. Megan, who runs the Legacy Group, she's a wonderful girl, and she's just the kind of person that in this area, they call the Legacy Group. They have amazing people that work there that really engage super well with all of the people there. But I would be remiss if I didn't share this kind of funny little poem that one of my sisters sent me the next day, because I was giving my sisters a really hard time that when my mom opened her presents, she opened like this box of like these little chocolate bars that were kind of crispy and crunchy. And my mom was so excited that somebody had given her this chocolate bar. But as she wanted to open up and eat one of them, she was told by my sisters, who I love dearly and they love me, but gosh, we love gigging each other. my sisters informed her that, no, Mom, you don't really need that chocolate bar right now. We need to eat some pizza. We need to eat this hamburger, or we need this cake, you know. And so, Mom, don't eat that. John, wait a second, ladies. She's 92 years old. This is her birthday party. Don't you feel she deserves, if she wants to eat a bit of a chocolate bar, why in the world can't she eat a bit of a chocolate bar? What, does she have to wait till she's 93 to eat a chocolate bar? So with that being said, my sisters all kind of looked at me like, hey, you're still our little brother. We'll decide this. So the next day, I couldn't stop but help, but I had to send them another text that, you know, hopefully when Mom's 93, she can eat what she wants. And I realize at 93, she is a different woman than she was at, say, 53 or 43 or even 23. But so my loving sister, my middle sister, who I love dearly, I think she and I were a lot alike. She wrote me this poem, and I'm going to share this poem with you. And hopefully you can see the humor in it. And if not, well, then when you're with your mom and she wants to eat something and your siblings are saying she can't, you might remember this. John, you are right. We do watch what Mama eats, especially when it comes to her in very special favorite treats. So while it may look bad and controlling to you, we just know for a fact what too much chocolate can do. Yes, last night, I kid you not, we had to run down the hall to get her to the pot. I've lost count of the number of times we've had to change her pants and clean her behind. So, John, what you feed her is always up to you. Just keep in mind that our sweet mama turned 92. And then there was this big heart and loving emoji that made me laugh. And I just felt like, and one of my producers said, John, you got to read that. Because again, I still stand by, if she has made it through her life and she's at her 92nd birthday, dementia or no dementia, diaper or no diaper, if she wants to eat a chocolate bar as her son, who always told Mom she could do whatever we want because she's responsible for her own life, I still think yes. And if you're the daughter out there who realizes that, wait, you know, John, how often do you take Mom to the bathroom? How often are you the one having to take care of the accident? Yeah, there's two sides to every story, but I still hold true. When I turn 92, I've told my sisters that if I want to drink one beer with my brother-in-law, Mark, and not wear a bib, by God, don't put a bib on me, and Mark can wear whatever he wants to wear. You know, men and women are different. Sons and daughters are different. That's what makes this world so great. But I just had to share that with you. That congratulations, Mom, 92 years. You are a big reason for why I'm here today. And love you. And I know you say you love to sing happy birthday, and you always say, and many more. And when you sang your birthday song six times because you didn't remember the other five, yeah, you didn't say, and many more. You said, yeah, I'm about ready to go. I'm ready to see my dad. So with that being said, why should I own my own business? Why should I have at least some opportunity in my life to own my own dig, to own my own passion? You know, with this little sabbatical, I got to realize why I feel everyone in the world at some point in your life should try to own your own business. You'll hear me say many times, when I started my business in 1983, 85% of all businesses went out of business within 5 years. That was a number and a percentage that was very true. And yet, John, you're telling people out there that with a potential 80 or 85% failure rate in 5 years, they should do their own thing, right? Yeah, I am. Because the way I look at it one way is this. I've worked with a lot of people in a lot of businesses as co-workers. We don't own the business. We didn't start the business, but we worked as co-workers. And I often heard my co-workers complain about the boss was an idiot. The boss has no idea what he's doing. The boss is not very smart. And I would often look at the person and say, hey, if you think you can do this better than he can, then what in the world are you doing here? Why are you upset about what the boss is having you do? Because if, in fact, the boss is an idiot, and side note, maybe some bosses are, why in the world are you working for this guy? Why don't you go out and you create your own lemonade stand? If this lemonade stand that you're working at, you don't like because you think your boss is an idiot and stupid, go start your own lemonade stand, right? I'm not telling everyone to start a lemonade stand. I'm just using a lemonade stand as a type of business that may be your passion. But here's what I think can happen, because I have seen it happen before. So you go out because you're passionate about a business. You are the smartest person in the world. You have everything under control. You've done all your research. You're now going to go out and you're going to start your lemonade stand, which is going to become not just a local, it's going to become a national lemonade stand, right? But 5 years later, for whatever reason, you no longer have your lemonade company. You no longer have your landscape company. You no longer have your lawyer office. You no longer are the owner of a plumbing company. Why was that? Well, in your mind, you may have 100 really good reasons on why you could not be an owner of your own business. You will have 1,000 other people to blame because the reason you failed was not your fault, right? It wasn't the things you decided. You may not have been a wrestler where you have to be accountable for every decision you make. But no, you may have a business that failed. And now guess what? You're now working for another business owner, right? And now, hopefully, if you're being true to yourself, you're going to look at this business owner in a different light. Because for some crazy reason, this idiot business owner, this stupid guy or girl who they do the dumbest things day in and day out, why are they still in business and you are not? If you're being absolutely true to yourself and honest with the guy or the girl looking in the mirror, you got to say, okay, I did it. I tried it. It didn't work. What is happening that this guy is doing it better? Well, this guy's business, he only has like 5 of us. You know, if I try to run a business with 50 people, or I try to run a business in this part of the city and my lemonade stand didn't, you know, quite attract as many people. If you try to own your own business, and I am certainly going to give you 40 reasons to do it, I'll give you one today. Maybe you won't make it. Maybe my formula, confidence, patience, and respect, maybe that won't work for you. But I will tell you this, because I've seen the people out there. If you fail at your business, you should, in my opinion, have a greater respect for this person you're working for. And you may have 100 reasons on why this person's business is successful, and it's maybe because he's a second generation, or maybe it's because he just started at the right time, or maybe, No. If you become a better employee because now you know what it takes to run a business, that's a good thing. Because here's the great part about life. You can always try it again. And maybe, just maybe, if you're smart enough, maybe you'll ask this boss who you now respect, maybe you'll ask him a lot of questions that you didn't ask him before you started your gig. So here's my reason today on why I think every single person at some point in their life should try to start their own business. If you're the kind of person that says, I never, ever, ever want to be a boss because I don't ever want to be the kind of person that has to be in charge of people or I have to tell people what to do, okay, that's good to know. That's good to know. You may be the kind of person that, hey, you know what? I'll tell you what, if I was ever going to start a business, it would be me and my dog. It would be me and my truck because I don't like working with other people. Okay, no problem. Try that. All right. A lot of businesses out there you're seeing are 2- and 3-man operations. All right. Nothing wrong with that. But here's just a really quick example of why me owning my business was so much better and so much more empowering and so much freer than me working for someone else. One of the things you're going to hear me talk about are actual numbers. You're going to hear me talk a lot about Dave Ramsey. And Dave, I met years and years ago, and every once in a while I try to get down and see Dave. But now that I'm on my sabbatical, hopefully I can see Dave more often. But I will tell you this, you like Dave or not, he's got amazing reasons on how and why you can become successful with money, the mistakes you make. I started listening to Dave about 35, 40 years ago, about the time I started my business. And I will just tell you this, his information is amazing. It's not always fun, but you follow Dave's plan and you follow it and you listen to it and you put your heart into it. I can tell you this, you have a much better likelihood of being successful financially than you will if you don't. But we'll talk about Dave on another day. Dave probably doesn't know me from Adam because we've only met a few times, but I've listened to Dave many, 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 many days. And Ramsey's, it was the Dave Ramsey Show. Now it's the Ramsey Show. Neat group. I was down there about 3 or 4 months ago and got to meet Jade and George Camel, and I'll tell you a funny story about them later. But all right, so I've been at this sabbatical. The book, hopefully someday, 5 years at Midtown, will be about this sabbatical. And I was able to start working there at an hourly rate that I was comfortable with because of selling my business, I didn't need a lot of money. I loved their fringe benefits. I loved their health insurance. I loved a lot of things that they had there. But here's an example. And again, nothing against the hospital. This was something I chose. But here is an example. When I started working there, the pay rate was lower than what I wanted for my position. So I had to do some negotiating with my managers to say, no, I need at least this much per hour. And because they really needed someone in this position, which was an outside landscaping maintenance position that allowed me to be outdoors 95% of my day, I got to be on equipment I didn't have to pay for. I got to see people that all I had to do was smile and wave. It was the perfect gig for me for where I had been for this part of my life. But they said to me, well, John, in order to make this amount, you're going to have to be a tech two. And I'm like, sure, great. What's a tech two mean? Well, how would you feel about going into hospital rooms and changing filters on occasion? That's interesting because I've told you before, I do not like hospitals, never have liked hospitals unless they're the maternity ward. But hey, you know what? I'll try it. Yeah, let's do it. So we agreed on this hourly rate. And yes, about 10% of my time for 2 years, I was going in and out of patients' rooms with a filter, pulling back a couch, opening up a vent, replacing the filter, coming back out, and going to another room. Now, I'll be honest, never really liking hospitals, this was a rude awakening. But like everything, I found the fun in it. But more importantly, as a communications major, oh my gosh, the conversations were amazing. And because I was behind the couch, I was a little bit like the fly on the wall. And being the fly on the wall, I got to hear some amazing conversations with HIPAA in mind. I'll share them later and there will never be names. But the point being, I negotiated what I was going to make per hour. But in order for them to pay me this per hour, I had to do more than just a little bit of outside work. And 2 years later, when I stopped doing filter work, I really had a whole lot of wonderful memories, scary memories a few times, absolutely hilarious memories other times. But here's the point I want to make. At the end of each year, if our department did well, if the hospital did well, if let's say we had a good year in the hospital, let's just say I was making about $17.50 an hour, which that's not a lot of money for some. For others, it's a lot of money, but for the fringe benefits and for what little I had to do, because don't take this the wrong way, I became pretty darn good at landscaping and lawn maintenance, maybe because of 30 years of experience. But because of what I got to do, that was fine. All right, $17.50, $18 an hour, right? But if the year went well and the hospital could afford it, we were given like a 2 to 2.5, sometimes 3% raise, right? So let's just, for argument's sake, let's say I was making $17.50 an hour. 2.7% of $17.50. Anybody? Any mathematicians out there? I don't know. What is that? Maybe 47 cents? So working a year, doing what I could, helping the hospital as best I could, and them being as good to me as you can imagine, because my God, I was de-stressed, not a care in the world, riding in circles, singing songs on a lawnmower, riding around in a Kubota or a mule kind of the Kawasaki thing. That's what I did most of the day. And all I got to do was wave at the people and say hi to the nurses. That's not bad for $17.50 an hour. But with my raise, I now was at $17.97 an hour. I made that 2.7% raise, right? So $7.50 to $7.97 an hour. Cool. When I started my business, the first 5 months of my business, mowing, mainly mowing, a little bit of trimming, using a leaf blower, I was grossing in that $30,000 to $35,000 a year. Okay. Not bad for a guy with a push mower, pickup truck, a weed eater. You know, this was back in 1983. Back then I was charging up between $40, $45 an hour, you know, and we'll get into those numbers another day. But years later, with confidence, patience, and respect, with doing my research, with talking to the right people, with having the confidence to go out and just ask 1,000 questions, I went from about $35,000 a year to years later, 1.4 million a year. It wasn't 2.5%. Now, granted, 1.4 million, that's a gross, okay? And we're going to talk a lot about gross numbers and net numbers. Because anytime you hear a number of what a business is making, ask that question, is that gross or net? There's a huge difference. But luckily, because of doing what I felt I needed to do and being respectful enough to people that definitely knew business better than I did, the numbers excelled tremendously. When you are an employee of any corporation, any company, and I don't care if there's four people, 40 people, 40,000 people, or 400,000 people, you do not always have and seldom have the control of where you're going to be able to be in 20 years. Yes, there are some amazing people at Deaconess. And you'll hear me talk about her a lot. Linda White, a lady that started very low. Now you go to Midtown, there is an entire building, the Linda White Hospice Center. There are those abilities to grow within a large corporation that can take you into amazing places, allows you to be an amazing person and give and give. As Dave Ramsey says, live like no one else so you can give like no one else. But my number one reason to consider doing your own thing is that after about 5 years, yeah, I went from $17.50 to almost $21.65 an hour. My choice, my decision, my ability in that hospital to see amazing things, do wonderful things, meet some great people. But in 5 to 6 years, about $2.50 to $3 more an hour. At this stage in my life, it was fine. If you're a young person starting out, you got to look at, okay, if I work here, what are my potential steps to where can I be in 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years? If you go after your own gig and you're willing to take the risks, let me repeat that. If you go after your own business and you're willing to take the risks, do yourself a favor. Spend about a year just researching owning your own business. If you're doing something you think you want to do for the rest of your life, if you are working somewhere and you absolutely love it, because by gosh, you get to do every day what you love, that is so important. But here's a little tip. If you think you want to do exactly what you're doing every day and you're already working somewhere, and you've got this drive to go out and do your own lemonade stand, do yourself a favor. Spend about a year working for that lemonade stand. Spend a year asking the questions every single day. Learn about the good days and how much that lemonade stand made. Learn about the bad days when there wasn't a single customer coming to your lemonade stand. Use a year to learn what is going to help you out to where every single day you're learning, but you're also making money. Far too often, I saw someone go after their passion because the work they were doing, they wanted to do their own thing. But man, they jumped into their passion and they jumped into a kettle of boiling water. Because their passion was maybe in their heart, but their passion was not also in their head. So that's my advice. If you think you found your passion and you're working for someone, Take about 6 months to a year and ask 1,000 questions and learn about the good days. Know your math. I don't care if he is grossing $50,000 a month with his lemonade stand, because if it's costing him $55,000 a month to run that lemonade stand, in about 3 or 4 years, that $5,000 per month loss is going to send him back working for someone else's lemonade stand. So, does that make sense? Very good. Well, I think I'm getting to the point where I'm ready to go out and start playing in my backyard. As I go, let me just throw out John 3:16, 3:17, MGC. What in the world does MGC stand for? And why is if God is going to be a part of John's life, does he have to be a part of my life listening to this podcast? Absolutely not. Remember, what's between you and your God is between you and your God. But Jesus Christ, our Lord and Savior, did not see fit to condemn man, then who are we to try? If that is John 3:16-3:17 with a colon, MGC, what in the world does MGC stand for? I don't know. Maybe right now it's a $500 question. So remember, get a chance today. Do yourself a favor. Try to find 10 minutes to yourself. If you're able to do it, try to find a natural place somewhere where you're all by yourself. And I don't know, give yourself a moment of silence. Give yourself a moment of peace. Turn off everything. See what appears. Is it a breeze? Is it a gentle smell of a blossom? Shoot, it may even be a little bunny rabbit that rushes out to get something to eat, likes you enough to stick around. Try to spend 10 minutes of every day doing something that you totally enjoy by yourself. Something that the rest of the world goes silent. And then dream. Dream about planting a seed. And where will that seed take me? So once again, I have told you, I have always just loved being around people. I love finding something positive. Have you ever been with a person and you're like, man, I've got to ask a lot of questions to find out something about this person that I can leave positive? But once you find that thing on that person that you find positive, dwell on that. Don't dwell on the other 10 things that drive you crazy about. Dwell on the thing that is positive. As I've told you many times, and I'll always tell you, I love my wife and I love my family. They complete me. I do a lot of things in my life in a lot of different ways with a lot of different people, but my wife and my family, they are the ones that complete me, because at the end of the day, having them in my life truly makes me happy. I love this amazing country and what it offers to everyone if you're willing to work hard and be patient. And my God, God, I love my God. He is an amazing person. If you ever get the chance to reveal yourself to him and he reveals yourself to you. But just remember, in all four of these entities, I find that their order does sometimes change. How about you? If you had to put these four, my country, my God, my family, just people, if you had to put those four in a list, higher, the best to the not so best, what would your list look like? It's between you and them. Well, my next podcast, if I get a chance, I'd really love to talk about something that I feel is very relevant today. I want to tell you a couple stories a couple stories that I feel are very, very important, because it seems like every night when I turn on the news and I see the Fox and I see the NNN and I go back and forth and I'm finding the best in both worlds and what's happening. And I'm hearing a lot about the isms, all the isms in the world and all the struggles we have with all the isms. And it hit me a while back that racism seems to be said a lot. I haven't counted it yet. I'll count it maybe one of these nights, how many times I hear about racism. I want to tell you a couple stories soon, but I don't want to dwell on the racism. I prefer to dwell on race relations. Race relations to me is a threat-reducing way of saying we've come a long way, but there's still work to be done. Race relations to me is more of where we can have a conversation of a few hundred years of this country, and maybe, just maybe, a conversation can continue where race relations is moving us forward. To me, racism and the way it's talked about and what is said is more threat-producing to a lot of people. So I want to share a couple stories with you, and I guess since this is my podcast, I get to talk uninterrupted. But I'd like to talk to you and dwell more on race relations, and we'll see where it goes. With that being said, I again can't thank you guys enough for listening to me today. I'm ready to now go out and have some fun, maybe get a little bit of exercise. Yeah, you know, with Father's Day, I did ask my wife, what are you getting me for Father's Day? And she gives me a list with about 10 things on it that she wants me to do. And I'm like, but wait. And she walks off. And so to all of you out there, I hope you have a great Father's Day. I hope you had a great Father's Day. Try to think of some of your most memorable moments. Next time, I'll tell you a funny story about my youngest son when he was 5. And we made it very clear to him that you never, ever, ever hit a girl. And I'll share a story he told us that I got to stop laughing inside. But again, thank you for listening to Trespassing Aloud. Tell your friends. Now this sabbatical will allow me to hopefully get a lot more of these out there to you much quicker. But have a great day. Have a great weekend. Have an empowering weekend. Have an empowering week to where you do what you want to do and hopefully help mankind along the way. That being said, have a great day. Take care.